over to Kat West from Skio Solutions to provide some introductions. So I'm going to call up our opening materials here, and then I know that it says Tom Bloom in that upper corner, but we unfortunately have not been able to get Tom on the line, so Kat West from Skio Solutions is going to provide that introduction on his behalf. So Kat, if you're there, please get started.
Well, welcome, everyone. Good morning and good afternoon, and thank you, Jean. Thank you all for tuning in to EPA Superfund Redevelopment webinar today. As Jean mentioned, my name is Kat West. I am a non-practicing environmental attorney and a redevelopment expert with Skio Solutions, who proudly supports the work of EPA's redevelopment initiative. And I am pleased to be here today because I am also a former EPA Region 4 redevelopment attorney. And so I'm really happy to be sharing all the great information that we have for you today. So EPA's Superfund redevelopment webinars share valuable site reuse information. They share success stories as well as challenges, and with the hope that these stories will inspire you to consider reuse on other blighted properties. Each of these webinars provides guidance and tools and lessons learned to support the appropriate reuse of Superfund sites. Today, we will discuss the cleanup and redevelopment of the Naval Industrial Reserve Ordnance Plant Superfund site, otherwise known as NIROC. We will hear the perspectives of Paul Hyde from Hyde Development on a successful redevelopment of the site into the Northern Stacks Industrial Park and Forgotten Star Brewery. So here's a preview of what we'll be covering today. I'm going to start with some brief background on Superfund redevelopment and the benefits of redeveloping contaminated properties before diving into an overview of the site history, the site cleanup, and the current status of the NIROC Superfund site. So Paul Hyde, president of Hyde Development, will then present the redevelopment of these sites. We're hoping that Paul's presentation of the exemplary results of the Northern Stacks Industrial Park may help inspire local government, tribal government, site owners, and others interested in finding developers for their properties, or inspire developers to consider the redevelopment of Superfund sites. And then I'm going to conclude the webinar with some resources and a question and answer session. So, Superfund redevelopment works with communities and other partners in considering future use opportunities and integrating appropriate reuse options into the cleanup process. It's really important to note that reuse considerations can, and I will emphasize, should be explored at any point during the Superfund cleanup process. There are many different ways to reuse Superfund sites, and there is really no one-size-fits-all solution to determining which reuse types will be the most appropriate. Contaminated sites pose unique challenges in terms of both cleanup and reuse. However, they can also allow for a broad spectrum of safe and productive reuse possibilities. Returning contaminated sites to productive use is an important part of EPA's mission. And the Superfund Task Force has developed recommendations for action and is diligently working to see those goals realized. And if you're interested in learning more about the Superfund Task Force, feel free to check out the link in your resources pod on the right of your screen. For more information about EPA's Superfund redevelopment, reuse, and redevelopment efforts, I encourage you to visit the Superfund redevelopment website. The link to the website is here on the slide and also listed in your resources pod on the right side of your screen. Part of the Superfund Redevelopment Roundtable webinar series, this training today will focus on opportunities, benefits, strategies, liability protections, and risk management for partnerships between developers and local and state and tribal governments. This interactive session will include a robust question and answer, as well as the opportunity for participants to share their perspectives on how to encourage more and faster Superfund site redevelopment across the country. Presenters will answer questions about available resources and support, share best practices, and update participants on the latest tools and guidance. Pictured left, on June 28, 2018, Pete Lopez, Regional Administrator for Region 2, presented the Excellence in Site Reuse Award to the City of Jersey City, the New Jersey Department of Environmental Protection, and Proglis Corporation for their efforts to develop the PJP Landfill Superfund site in Jersey City. And EPA redesigned the cap to accommodate redevelopment, and the site is now a state-of-the-art warehouse and distribution center. And then pictured on the right, on August 2nd, 2020, EPA Region 3 Administrator Cosmo Servidio presented the Excellence in Site Reuse Award to Jeffrey Marshall, President of Heritage Conservancy, for outstanding work in the reuse of the Croydon TCE Superfund site. The Heritage Conservancy acquired 80 acres of the Croydon site in 2016 and operates a nature preserve that is one of the last remaining coastal plain forests in Pennsylvania. This preserve provides publicly accessible green space in a developed area of Bucks County and is inhabited by many, many critters. So I encourage you to visit the Redevelopment Partnerships page of the Superfund Redevelopment website as well, to learn about much more about the specific organizations that have partnered with Superfund Redevelopment to assist in Superfund site reuse. Collaborating with these organizations helps Superfund Redevelopment provide appropriate tools and resources to turn reuse visions and plans into reality. Superfund Redevelopment currently has partnerships with the Academy of Model Aeronautics, the U.S. Soccer Foundation, the Rails to Trails Conservancy, the Trust for Public Land, and Pollinator Partnership. These organizations are familiar with Superfund and are very willing to work with communities, municipalities, and other stakeholders to explore reuse opportunities and resources for their local Superfund sites. And one final note, please feel free to submit your questions throughout the webinar. We're going to have plenty of time at the end for questions as well as some survey questions for you to respond to. Okay, with that, I am going to provide a brief overview of the Naval Industrial Reserve Ordnance Plant Superfund site and to lay the groundwork for Paul Hyde's in-depth discussion of the redevelopment of the site. So, the site history. The site occupies about 83 acres in Fridley, Minnesota, south of Interstate 694, and east of Interstate I-94 and the Mississippi River, if you know the location. In 1940, the Northern Pump Company, under contract to the Navy, constructed a new manufacturing plant and began naval weaponry and equipment for the Navy. This plant was partially owned by Northern Pump Company and partially owned by the government, making it a government-owned, contractor-operated facility. And during World War II, this plant would go on to earn the Navy's Excellence in Production Award 7 times, making it one of 8 facilities out of 86,000 to earn this award this many times. So beginning in 1940, the NILOP facility was constructed and operated under contract to the Navy to produce naval weaponry and equipment. NILOP was later operated by the FMC Corporation. The plant was partially owned by the government and partially by the Northern Pump Company. In 2004, the Navy sold the NILOP property to the United Defense Limited Partnership. And in 2005, this partnership sold the property to ELT Minneapolis, LLC. And this company owned the former NIROP property and leased the space back to the partnership until 2013, at which time ELT Minneapolis sold the property to Fridley Land, the current landowner. That's a lot of history. hopefully you followed that. In the early 1970s, the operators began to dispose of paint, sludge, and solvents in pits and trenches on the site, on the part of the site called the North 40 area. And the former plating shops were later identified as an additional source area. Improper waste disposal practices led to groundwater, surface water, and soil contamination. EPA added this site to the Superfund program's national priority list in November of 1989. So let's talk about site cleanup. So prior to the site's listing on the national priorities list, the Navy did conduct its first cleanup activity in 1983, removing waste drums and contaminated soil. The site was divided into three OUs, operable units, and OU1 addressed contaminated groundwater, OU2 addressed contaminated soils, except for those underneath the former plating shop, and OU3 addressed contaminated soils beneath the former plating shop. Hyde Development, a Minneapolis-based development company that has experience developing other Superfund sites, including the Joslin Manufacturing and Supply Company site and the Boise Cascade Medtronic site, expressed interest in redeveloping this site in 2012. EPA made it clear the site areas would need to be cleaned up to commercial and industrial use standards. The EPA, the Minnesota Pollution Control Agency, the Navy, and Hyde Development worked very closely and very collaboratively to redefine the site OUs in 2013 to facilitate the redevelopment. And through this collaboration, Hyde Redevelopment enrolled the site in the state's voluntary investigation and cleanup program, providing a clear path for prospective purchasers, developers, and other parties to implement cleanup site activities under state oversight through a phased approach. And this program complemented federal and state Superfund program cleanup activities and provided a way to implement the cleanup actions much more quickly. So original plans called for redeveloping the site over a 10-year period, but thanks to this expedited cleanup and this collaborative approach, the cleanup was actually finished in 6 years, 4 years ahead of schedule. The Navy is redesigning its groundwater treatment system, and a more efficient, lower-cost system is estimated to be in place sometime this year. So the current site status. The NIROP site is now proudly home to the Northern Stacks Industrial Park. The Northern Stacks Industrial Park is home to a variety of businesses, including manufacturing industries, entertainment service providers, military equipment contractors, and more. Businesses continue to open at the site with, I think my favorite, the Forgotten Star Brewing Company being the latest. The Forgotten Star Brewing Company is housed in the NIROP facility's former boiler room, which houses the two smokestacks that inspired the name of the industrial park. The industrial park also seeks to be more than just a place to work. It also includes patio areas with organized food truck days, how exciting, and has included paved trails that connect to regional trails along the Mississippi River. The Renew Award can be given to local, state, tribal, federal, or private sector partners who have demonstrated excellence in working cooperatively with EPA Region 5 to support safe and responsible cleanup and reuse, especially those that promote innovative and sustainable reuse outcomes. On October 28, 2019, EPA Region 5 participated in a celebration of the final phase of development at the Naval Industrial Reserve Ordnance Plant Superfund site in Fridley, Minnesota. At the event, EPA Region 5 presented awards to the U.S. Department of the Navy, the Minnesota Pollution Control Agency, and Hyde Development. And I think this is a picture inside the Forgotten Star Brewery, and we'll ask Paul if he can confirm that. So now I will turn the presentation over to Paul Hyde of Hyde Development. Hyde Development is a family-owned commercial real estate developer and investor based in Minneapolis, Minnesota. Paul and Mac Hyde co-founded Hyde Development in 2012 with a focus on urban redevelopment and brownfield sites. Since then, the company has completed over 4.4 million square feet of industrial and office development in Minnesota, Colorado, and North Dakota. Paul is going to discuss the extraordinary redevelopment of the NIROP site. Paul, take it away.
Good afternoon. It's good to be a part of this. I am waiting for my screen to pop up here. Is my PowerPoint on now?
Give it one moment, Paul. There we go. It is
great.
Up now.
Great. Well, it's great to be here, and I'm here today to walk you through the different elements of redeveloping a Superfund site from the perspective of a developer. We've been fortunate to develop four Superfund sites in our career as a previous company, Real Estate Recycling, and now with Tide Development. We've been focused on redeveloping polluted sites since 1996. And why do we do that? We think we've got better real estate risk by taking on some environmental risk and carefully mitigating that environmental risk. My dad and I co-founded the company. My dad was an that's him in the compactor about to run me over. My dad was an environmental lawyer here in Minneapolis for many years. And I had gone to law school, just graduated, and started working at a law firm here in town, and wasn't as enthusiastic about being a lawyer as I was something that gave me a little bigger picture perspective on projects and putting deals together. And I talked to my dad and mom and said, why don't we take dad's expertise as an environmental attorney and start a real estate company that will focus on redeveloping these polluted sites? This was 1995. Minnesota had passed one of the first voluntary cleanup programs in the nation, and this was the beginning of the brownfields era. Since then, we've gone on to develop over 3 million square feet, probably 3.5 million square feet of industrial product on infill sites, both in Minneapolis and Denver, Colorado, and Fargo, North Dakota, and have a real love and affinity for these partnerships that are required to make these complicated developments happen. So let me walk you through the STAX project today. You've got to understand where we were in the past. And the slide before you now is the Northern STAX before picture. And this was the site when we bought it in 2013. We'd had it under contract for probably almost 2 years before that, trying to get our arms around all the issues we're going to describe in this conversation. But by 2013, we were ready to close. And what we had here was a 2 million square foot building on a 122-acre site. It was both a state and federal listed site. And the building itself, when we took over, had five different tenants, the largest of which was BAE Systems, the defense contractor successor to the Northern Pump you heard about in the introduction. So when we started, it was already complicated with the state and federal Superfund status, five different tenants, the second biggest building in the state of Minnesota, and a big site. This site had a rich history. It had started out producing pumps for fire suppression systems, and then after December 7, 1941, they quickly switched to manufacturing guns, assembling gun systems for Navy cruisers and destroyers. You'll see right here in this picture here on the lower right, this is an all-company meeting, and this facility, when it was running full steam, had three shifts, working 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, with 3,500 people working on site. You can see some of the manufacturing lines here. You can see some of the guns being assembled here. And then down here, this is one of the Battle E awards. You can see the E up there and the V for victory on either side. As was discussed, this site received seven Battle E awards, which is the Navy's premier award for efficiency and excellence, one of the top plants in the country. And a real part of the history of the site that we wanted to cherish and sort of keep alive in our branding of the park. So why take on this Superfund site with this big wonky building and these five tenants? Well, because it's an infill site. You see here, 694 is our ring road in the Twin Cities. So this is within the inner ring. It was the largest available piece of ground within the inner ring at 122 acres. So the location drove all of this, and it had an outstanding location. But that came with a very complex environmental regulatory situation. And it wasn't without the strong partnership from the city, the Housing Redevelopment Authority in Fridley, and city staff, along with EPA and the State Pollution Control Agency, that we got through it. And here we are day one, looking at this site, and there was only two spots of available vacant land. The rest was consumed by this 2-million-foot building, and most of that available vacant land was tied up with parking for BAE and some of the tenants in the building. So that's how we found it. And then it had all these issues. And the way we attacked this was to kind of put each of the issues in their own bucket. The first bucket was land use. We had to get the appropriate zoning to allow for our modern industrial park, which would incorporate a number of different uses. And the threshold there was a requirement for either an environmental impact statement or alternative urban area-wide review. We didn't want to spend a year and six figures demonstrating how much better we would make this polluted Superfund site. We wanted to get to doing the work. But the city attorney was quite firm in thinking, and she was right, that we met these certain statutory hurdles just because of the size of the project, that we had to do something. And what we came up with was the alternative urban area-wide review, or as I call it, sort of the Diet Coke version of the EIS. It saved us some money and probably 3 months worth of time. So that process looked at all the different environmental impacts from the current situation and how our redevelopment would improve those. And the next thing we had to do after that was done was amend the comprehensive plan. This is the long-term planning document cities have to look 20 to 30 years out. And no one had ever imagined that the site could be redeveloped. So the comprehensive plan never contemplated a redevelopment of the project. And we had to go amend this comprehensive plan in order to rezone the site to something that was consistent with the amended comp plan. All this took a year. And then once the comp plan was amended, we had to dig into the actual rezoning. The existing M2 heavy industrial zoning allowed all sorts of heavy manufacturing that the city was keen to eliminate and create a more modern, greener, environmentally friendly park. And so we were fine with that. But in exchange, we wanted some flexibility on the use because we foresaw that our park could accommodate a wide variety of uses that may require us to go back to the city and keep asking for special use permits or conditional use permits, the brewery being a great example of one of those. And we came up with this very creative solution the city did for essentially what's a planned unit development. And the simplest way to say it is this S2 zoning gave us kind of our own custom zoning, and it covered everything from building setbacks and dimensions to landscape criteria to parking requirements to uses. And that was a key to facilitating the speedy lease up and development of the site. Suffice it to say, we also had significant environmental issues. The site was listed on the NPL, which is EPA's national priority list, but it was also listed on the state counterpart, the PLP. And there's been a long enforcement framework in history. And I think the length of this site in the Superfund program, at one time it was scored the highest ranking Superfund site in the United States at one time. And there was a complicated relationship between the Navy and EPA and PCA. There had been cleanup that had been done. There was a regulatory framework and a consent decree that had sort of managed the relationship and those cleanup activities. And then we were going to come in and screw that all up by turning it upside down and wanting to go a lot faster and wanting to run all of this through the state's voluntary investigation and cleanup program so that we had no delays in doing our cleanup and developing our buildings. And most importantly, we were able to get the liability protections from that state voluntary program that could give our tenants and banks and investors comfort. That was super, super important to be able to shift this paradigm from sort of the consent decree enforcement model into a voluntary cleanup market-based model driven by the real estate development timeline. And I can't give enough credit to EPA Region 5 for saying, you know what, I remember the meeting, we were sitting in Chicago. We've got a robust and experienced voluntary program at the state of Minnesota. We're just going to let them run with this. We've still got our connections to the Navy and the RPs, but we're going to let the state run this cleanup and redevelopment piece. And that couldn't have been a more important step for us to get started and really gave us the green light to start the redevelopment project. Other things that happened
is... Line.
Oh, hey, Tom.
Hi, Paul.
Other things that happened that were super important as a part of that is we were able to create a really neat kind of trusting environment between the Navy and EPA, PCA, and the tenant in that existing building, BAE. All of them had these residual environmental issues that hadn't been addressed in the original cleanup, and you heard those referenced in the introduction. The Navy had the former plating shop, which was believed to be a source. We were going to tear down that part of the building, which gave the Navy a chance to clean that up. BAE had a paint shop issue also underneath part of the existing building that we were going to tear down. That gave them a chance to clean that up. And what we were able to create with sort of this urgent redevelopment timeline was an opportunity for BAE and the Navy to go in and address some source area removal, something that EPA and PCA had been looking at for a number of years. And they did it fast and they did it effectively and for a lot less money than they'd been carrying in their worst fears. And that kind of cooperation was really a unique feature of this project that made it a win-win for everybody and ultimately led to different operable units of the site being listed starting in 2015 and then even into the last year or so. Nevertheless, the 7 groundwater extraction wells, which extract groundwater heading towards the river, treat it, they continue to run. That's the Navy's responsibility. We designed our park around those wells, and the Navy will continue to operate that, including this year. putting in some new wells and a new treatment building that will incorporate very nicely into the design of the park. The next, after we've dealt with the land use issues and the environmental issues, we had to go pay for this, which was no small feat. There's two types of financing that we had to get. We had to go get some private financing, which fell into two different buckets, equity to help us buy the land, and then loans from a bank or debt to help us build the buildings. Once those buildings are built, that construction loan, which is designed to be a short-term loan, is converted into a longer-term permanent loan. And each time you go through debt or equity or construction or permanent financing, the first thing people ask about is the environmental situation. So we had really had to have that buttoned up, both in terms of our work and our assurances, to satisfy those folks that we had addressed the environmental risk. Even with that debt and equity, there still wasn't enough money to finish paying for the project, specifically the extraordinary costs. So the public financing was the other piece of the puzzle. We obtained grants for the cleanup of the site, both from the state, which is DEED, and a regional group called the Metropolitan Council. We also secured tax increment financing from the city of Fridley and some additional DEED grants to cover the infrastructure, which is stormwater pipes, sanitary lines, new roads, new traffic lights, that sort of thing. And we had a third need, which was I call sort of the startup money to fund our environmental investigations when we first started the project. We knew there'd been some cleanup done. We couldn't access the TIF or the grants until we'd done some updated investigation. We needed to know what was out there, where it was, and how much there was of it. And so the city worked a very clever solution to give us some city grants, probably around $250,000 per four phases of the site, so $1 million total, that we were able to go do phase one, phase two, and response action plan work that qualified us to go get the TIF and grants we needed to finish that work. When you're looking at financing, both for the acquisition of the site as well as for the loans to build the building, you have to look at what we were able to do here as something very clever. We bought the site for $13 million, roughly, in July of 2013, and we had roughly $4 million in equity and a $9 million loan to buy that site. And then that 2 million square foot building stayed up for a year or two, and we used the rent we were getting from those five tenants to pay the loan down that helped us acquire the site. We were able then to secure construction loans, which were used to pay for the building of the buildings themselves, as well as soft costs associated with that construction. A super important part of this is that we built these buildings speculatively, meaning we built the buildings without a tenant. And that's a risky thing to do. And you'd say, well, geez, why would you do that kind of crazy, risky spec development? And the answer is, in the industrial world, the tenants don't leave themselves enough time these days. When I first started, tenants would leave themselves a year to find a new building. Now they leave you 9 weeks or 12 weeks or 16 weeks at the most. So you need to have a building up and completed, and the only final piece of that is building out the tenant's particular space. So without a speculative building, you're never going to land a tenant. You're just not going to have enough time. So we had to convince the bank that we were going to be able to do this cleanup, to get it clean, to build this spec building, and then lease it. And that was a leap of faith. that a bank that we've done several of these with was able to take with us, because we were able to document the assurances that we would receive from the state VIC program. We could show them all the investigation work that we had done. We could show them we had a cleanup plan approved. We could show them we had the grant and TIF money to execute the cleanup plan and build the infrastructure. All we had to do at that point was execute. Everything else was done to set the table. And that's how we were able to convince them to get the loans to start the project. On the public financing side, we've hinted at this, but we needed a total of about $12 million in pollution cleanup costs in funded by grants, plus $20 million in infrastructure costs. And the infrastructure, again, roads, sanitary lines, new water lines, storm sewer pipes, new roads, new traffic interchanges and controls. And there wasn't enough grant funding for the entire project at once. The state of Minnesota has a grant program. It has two application cycles, May and October. And what you have to do is fit your grant application into the amount of money available. And so we figured the only way to do that was to carve the site into four bites, four pieces of pizza, if you will. And we attacked each site at each grant cycle rather than try to do the whole thing at once. So there was certainly risk there as well, because we were only getting through and cleaning up and knowing what we were facing on a phase-by-phase basis. And then lastly, the critical piece that the city of Fridley provided were these startup grants that helped fund our phase one, phase two investigations and our response action plans. The city then was another brilliant partner on the tax increment side. The city grants for the phase one, phase two work we've referenced, they were funded by hazardous substance subdistrict grants, or grants from a hazardous substance subdistrict tax increment financing. And what that essentially means is that's taking what the existing taxes are today with the existing BAE building and uses those taxes to fund our grants. So the city would give us the grant money, we would spend it doing our testing, and that would be reimbursed by the property taxes we were paying and that existing property tax base. And then we also were able to get deed and Met Council grants for pollution cleanup on the phased approach that I described. We had, I think, well, we'll see on the next slide, a $500,000 or so deed infrastructure grant and some redevelopment grants. But the majority of the work to do the infrastructure was the pay-as-you-go tax increment. And quite simply, that's looking at what the building was worth today or the polluted land today. And then a year and a half from now, when we've done our cleanup, it's worth more. And we've added a new building, it's worth more. And it will get assessed at a higher value and create a higher revenue stream on the property tax piece. And that stream is used to finance the $20 million cost we had to put in that infrastructure. Here's a quick look at the overall budget. As you can see, this is a big project. It's 1.8 million feet. And the different costs come down into buying the land to building the 1.8 million feet of buildings. The cap is the asphalt pavement where we put residually impacted soil that met the industrial standards. Infrastructure, ponds and pipes, et cetera. Development costs, that's primarily building out tenant spaces. And brokerage fees to tenant brokers, and loan costs and legal costs. There's the environmental cleanup at $14.7 million. We had a very innovative solution on the demolition. We tore down two-thirds of that existing 2 million square foot building to make room for future buildings. We had planned to tear the whole darn thing down, but BAE said, you know what, we want to stay in a piece of this building. It's too expensive to replace, so we'd like to stay in this 500,000 square feet here on the north side of the building. And we said, great, fine. So we signed a lease with them, but we still had to tear down 1.5 million feet. And this was a $6 or $7 million number. And Braun, our environmental engineer, was marvelous in getting bids from contractors that incorporated the scrap value of all the copper and steel that was in the buildings, which dramatically offset the cost of that demolition work and took that from a $6-7 million number down to a $1.5 million number. And then we had some money we had to pay to relocate some of those tenants in the building. So how do we pay for this? This is a great look at the stack of different capital used on these polluted sites. We had $8.7 million in grants from DEED and Met Council. That was 5% of the budget. We had these HRA grants from the city for investigation and for environmental cleanup. We had the TIF from the city at $22 million that ended up only being about $17 million. Here's our equity in paying for the land. We borrowed the money to build the buildings from the bank. At this, we put in another $2 million to help cover some other costs. But, you know, long story short, you know, 78% of this cost is from our equity or our construction loan, and the rest is from these different sources, different tranches of funds that are available to help these redevelopments happen. And without those funds, this never would have happened, because our cost to build this would have been higher than a neighbor's cost. Our competing sites were all in greenfield sites, so we would have been much more expensive and would have never had any leasing success. So kudos to these kind of programs that make this redevelopment possible. So let me look at BAE now. This is really kind of a fun story. This is BAE's map showing them occupying portions of the 2 million square foot building when we bought it. And what you'll see here in green and yellow and red is all spots that BAE was occupying. And what we were going to do is cut right through here, up here and over here. This was our cut line. Everything up here stayed. All this stuff down here went in the dumpster. And right down here, that's the boiler room, which we retained because we thought the smokestacks were cool. It turned out to be something even better later. But so we had a very complex project to cut through this building while BAE occupied. And you can imagine the engineers, you know, they're very precise people. They didn't like the sounds and the rattling and this sort of thing. We had to transfer all the power, all the phone and data was down here. We had to go put that up here. We had to take one existing boiler out here, put it up here, add another boiler here. All sorts of work to kind of adaptively reuse this building and make it possible for them to stay. And why did we go through all these gymnastics? Well, it's because BAE, when we bought the building, had a lease. The lease gave them an option to renew, and if they renewed, it'd have to be in that same 1.2 million square foot green and yellow shaded area. But they didn't need all that space, so they were eager to stay but shrink their footprint. But I could prevent them from staying and shrinking their footprint. So we arrived at a solution, which was the redevelopment of this building, with them consolidating in that 560,000 feet. And me taking the rest, tearing it down and making room for future buildings. That resulted in us being able to go after the plating shop soils here, because I tore that down, and the paint shop soils down here, because we tore that down. That's how we were able to get that additional cleanup done. Our investment in this was about $26 million, but it did magnificent things in retaining these 600 plus highly skilled engineering jobs in Minnesota without any sort of job grant to keep DAE in the state. So that was a magnificent result. Then we had to go find new leases for all the other buildings we were going to build. And we had to overcome a lot of negative stereotyping. There were negative perceptions of the Superfund site. There were negative perceptions that once operating at 24/7, 365 with 3,500 people, they were down to 500 people because they'd moved a bunch of the manufacturing out of state when we bought the site. So we had sort of this dark cloud over the Superfund site and a site that seemed sort of sleepy and abandoned. And we had to create an appealing identity that would want, get people to want to come there and locate their business there. And on top of that, we were building these buildings speculatively again, which proved that we were committed as a developer, but we really had to do something to sell people on why they should come to this site. Add on top of all that, we were tearing down that 1.5 million feet as we were trying to get our first new building built and leased. There was a lot of noise, a lot of dust, huge piles of steel and concrete. It was hard to get buildings leased. How did we address that? Well, we decided to do something which doesn't sound that radical, but it was at the time. We didn't paint the buildings brown. A lot of buildings in Minnesota, many industrial buildings painted brown. We went with a bold modern design that had a lot of glass, that had orange and this gray. It had this perforated metal panels that they lit up at night. That would accommodate a wide variety of users. We had enough trailer parking, trailer storage, as well as car parking to attract distribution users or our manufacturing and R&D users. We had a variety of clear heights, ceiling heights, which would allow different uses. Our floors were super flat, which is critical for this new laser-guided technology that is running most of these warehouses today. And we had column spacing that was up to the norm in terms of the latest distribution centers. And then we saw that we were right next to a vibrant kind of artsy neighborhood in Northeast Minneapolis. And we did a lot of marketing to kind of connect our location to that neighborhood as a hip, fun place that people want to be, that's growing and thriving. And then as we got leases done, we kept building on that leasing momentum. The first leases were super hard to get for all the reasons we discussed. First building, demolition, construction, Superfund site. But once people saw that second building go up and the demolition activity had slowed down and the piles of concrete were gone, people got it. They got the new product on the infill site, and that's when things really started to roll. As a result, we got 10 buildings on the site, the biggest of which is the BAE Technology Center, which is that 560,000-foot building we discussed, which was really an adaptive reuse of the existing building. We also got constructed 7 new buildings, 2 bulk buildings, 3 office warehouse buildings, that have kind of less office space, but 2 office warehouse buildings that had much higher office finish. And then 2 years ago, we bought an existing building across the street, Stacked 8. It was a 1980s vintage building, and we renovated that to be a part of the Northern Stacks Park, both by look and with much needed improvements. And finally, which we'll discuss in a minute, we were able to turn that old boiler room into a brewery. This slide is one of my favorites. What this is showing you is the tenant migration. All these dots are really Northern Stacks. So you're seeing all these tenants. They were all about to head up here. This was where all the greenfield stuff was. Brooklyn Park, Rogers, and they all stop at our site because they're leaving existing sites in the city because those buildings are functionally obsolete. They're headed out here, but when we delivered that solution much closer in, it was better for their employees and better for their customers. And we had very strong success, and it was alluded to earlier. We finished this in 5.5 years, and we had projected it would be a 10-year project. Here's a look at the park today. I like this slide because it shows the diversity of tenants that the different buildings we built created. We've got Horaeus, which is a medical R&D facility that's just opened here. We've got automotive parts. We've got V-Star, who puts on shows for trolls or bubble guppies or this sort of thing. We've got a paper distributor here. We've got a hydraulic manufacturer here, a testing firm here. So a wide variety of uses that will provide a much more stable economic base in trying times, and we're even seeing that in the last 2 months, much more stable base and tougher. It's tough on the communities when you have a big company that occupies a large building and they leave. There's a ton of jobs that leave and the property taxes crater. Now, that's never going to happen here because you've got so many diverse tenants as part of the park. And then here's Stack 8. This is the building we bought, a 1980s building, and incorporated into the park this year. Here's an aerial looking towards downtown Minneapolis. Downtown Minneapolis here. Here's Mississippi River. Here are the Stacks 1 and 2 buildings. This used to be the southern parking lot. Here's the boiler room, 3, 4, and 5. All this used to be part of the 1.5 million square foot building we tore down. Here's BAE, the adaptive reuse, Stacks 6 and 7, and then Stacks 8 is right over here. We bought this a year and a half ago, 200,000 foot office warehouse building. We spent now over $13 million on this. It had its own cleanup, ironically, a bunch of stuff related to the old FMC site and BAE site, NIROF site, that had sort of never been as hot as what was going on to the south. But we found a lot of the same vapors and some of the same issues there, but also some new issues that had come about from that facility having been a commercial printer. We just finished our cleanup there and are going to sign this week our last lease to turn that building to 100% occupancy.
So, ladies and gentlemen, this is Jean Ballant. I just wanted to confirm, Paul, you may have accidentally muted yourself. Are you still there on the line?
Yep, sorry about that.
No problem.
I was just saying that here we're looking at the Stacks right here. These are the Stacks that had the Battle E Award painted on them. And we kept those because we thought it was such a cool part of the brand. But when we looked in the space, and you can see on the left-hand side of the slide, here are the old boilers. Once we cleaned the boilers out, it had a lot of glass and natural light. Once we peeled off, all these windows were covered by wrinkly tin metal paneling. We pulled those off. We're like, good grief, look at these great window openings. And it was just a beautiful, bright, open space. And so we were able to land Forgotten Star Brewing. The story there is that when they painted the Battle E up on the Stacks, they forgot one of the seven stars. And when we were renovating it, our friends at BAE reminded us that there was a star missing. We painted it back on, and the brewers just loved the name of that for the brewery. So Here's a look at Forgotten Star. And this goes into a larger issue, which is these industrial parks these days, it's about being a nice place to work, but it's also about creating community. And our focus is on the people working there, that they have a variety of things to experience that make them want to be there. And so we've worked hard at creating different things that make it a place people like to work. We've got Food Truck Fridays every Friday. You see on the lower left, there's a 3-mile trail system that winds all throughout Stax. We've got a trail map out. And we actually got one lease because the guy said, I love walking during lunch, and that's when I do my best thinking. I'm coming here because you have walking trails. We have a number of park-wide programs that we do, usually every other week. We had a pumpkin chucking contest at Halloween. We'll have something coming up for the spring when we're able to get back together. And then we had a cafe on site, which provides breakfast and lunch, and that's a huge amenity for the park to be able to get food on site. What are the results? About 1.8 million square feet of building completed to date, 1,400 jobs on site now, and $100 million in new tax base created from this. So benefits abound from this sort of polluted site redevelopment. The project's been recognized on the cover of the National NIAP magazine and various local awards. And then just three last slides on other Superfund sites that we've done. We did a lead site in St. Louis Park, Minnesota called National Lead in 2008. You can see the lead slag here. We actually had to have the guys in the suits with the respirators and blood tests and everything. The lead was so hot there. And we remediated that site and put up a 80,000-foot office showroom called our Highway 7 Business Center. We also did a similar four-building industrial park on an old wood treating site. Here's us treating the soils. They had done cleanup there, but there was still additional cleanup that needed to take place. And we did that work and created a four-building industrial park that brought back 750 jobs and $40 million in tax base. And then finally, an ag chem site called Howe Fertilizer. There was an ag chem site. There was a fire in the middle of the winter. The ag chem went everywhere. It froze. This is simply there to show you that this little 60,000-foot building on a six-acre site may have been harder than almost anything else I've worked on. So the little ones aren't necessarily easier. So lessons learned. As I said at the beginning, what we're trying to do is trade some environmental risk for higher quality, less risky real estate. That migration map shows that. The small sites are just as hard as the big ones. I like these big Superfund sites because you're working with the same team on the same set of problems on a much bigger project. And just so crucial is having a committed, creative, and persistent team that's focused on the same goal. And that's the city, that's the PCA, it's the EPA, it's the grant funders, it's our contractor, our environmental consultants, our brokers, our banks. And to be able to do this and have fun with those folks really makes it a rewarding process. And I think the love and care all those stakeholders have in the project kind of comes out at the end. You can really see that. That's it for me. That's the end of my presentation.
Okay, so I believe that we now have Tom Bloom from EPA Region 5 with us on the line. So, Tom, if you have been able to connect, feel free to come off of mute and say hello. So I know Tom was with us just a few moments ago. So, again, Tom, if you're connecting on the phones, Remember, you'll need to unmute your line. It's #6.
Can you hear me now?
We can hear you now. Hi, Tom.
Oh, my God. What a technical difficulty I've been having just the last little bit here. Well, now you can hear me.
Yes.
I'm sorry that I didn't make it. Okay. Well, I want to thank Paul for that fantastic presentation. It's very interesting to hear about the processes that you used for developing the NIROP site, and it's amazing the results of all of your hard work. You know, showcasing Superfund case studies is important to the Superfund redevelopment mission. And along with providing samples, we found that sharing guidance tools, lessons learned, and resources is an impactful way to promote safe and beneficial reuse. I'd like to wrap up our time today with providing with some additional resources, and then we'll use the remaining time for any additional questions. Can I go to the next slide? Yes, I can, I think. Thank you. Here's a list of our tools that we use. We encourage you to look into these tools on our website. You can find them all in the resources panel. One of the things that's not mentioned on this list here is the use of the VIC program, which really came in handy at the NIROP for identifying residual contamination and getting it cleaned up quickly. And then also the delisting process. I think that was another thing that we used here at NIROP that really helped out to get things going. All right, let me get to the next slide. Okay. This is a slide that leads us to the, it's on your resource panel. It's for the final task force, final Superfund task force report, and it outlines the accomplishments of the Superfund task force. This was put together earlier in last year. We had 5 sites in Region 5 that we tried to expedite cleanup on and get back into reuse, and we did pretty good with 4 or 5 of them being put back into reuse now. Next slide. And here's a list of all the coordinators like me. There's one of us in every region. If you have any region-specific or site-specific questions, these are the folks you should reach out to as needed. We talk just about once a month, and we talk to each other about things that are going on in our regions, different ways how we thought out of the box to get things accomplished, and it's a great group of people that are very dedicated to Superfund redevelopment and reuse. And finally, for more information, if you have any general questions or you'd like more information about Superfund reuse, please don't hesitate to contact our project manager, Frank Avastato, in headquarters. Now I'd like to take a minute to pause for us to answer a few questions. And while we're going over the questions, we're going to switch the screen to a survey screen for you to take a few minutes to respond to the questions. And then we'll go and look at the questions that we were given, and we'll come up with some answers for you while you're going through the survey. Thank you very much.
So thank you, Tom, and thank you, Paul. This is Kat West again, and that was truly great. So much useful and practical information really to apply to the art and the skill of redevelopment. And Paul, at some point, I would love to be invited to your pumpkin chucking contest. That sounds like so much fun.
It's amazing. It's big time. We'll put you down.
I would love it. Thank you. And so while folks are looking at the survey questions, I'm going to be going through some of the questions that have come in on the side, and I want to encourage everyone, if you haven't submitted a question or if you want to submit another question, go ahead and do that now. And just to let you know that your responses to the survey questions are really, really valuable for EPA and for the Superfund Redevelopment Initiative. They are going to use that information to improve the information and the tools and the support that really is going to be provided to communities and local and tribal governments and to developers. So thank you in advance for filling this out. And while you're doing that, I'm going to go to the first question here. And actually, this is one of my favorite questions, so thank you so much for asking this. The question is, at what
stage in the Superfund process is it the best time to start having redevelopment discussions? And Tom, I'm going to turn that over to you first and see if Paul wants to answer.
You want me to answer first or turning to me first?
Yeah, Tom, why don't you go for it?
Yeah. Well, actually, there, all different phases it is good to engage. There isn't any special phase that makes it go better or not. I mean, we've got some sites like the Blackwell Forest site where they thought about it very early in the cleanup of reusing the site for a sledding hill, and they incorporated recreational kind of concerns into their cleanup and everything like that. And that worked out great, and it helped things to go a little bit smoother. But then we have some sites that, you know, nobody, that we've cleaned up and everybody's forgotten about, and a developer comes along and says, hey, this is right along a highway. What's going on with this? Nobody knows anything about it. It's already been preliminary closed out. It's an O&M. And sometimes those are the best ones to gather information on and see what's going on and see whether we can get it back into a productive use. So I don't know if there's any certain phase that's the best for getting reuse to happen.
Great. Thanks, Tom. And I know that Superfund redevelopment often encourages reuse and redevelopment discussions as early as possible in the cleanup, because once those discussions start to happen, then often EPA can take that information, the proposed reuse, and factor it into the cleanup, and it can often result in faster cleanup, maybe less expensive cleanups, because maybe a building footprint could take the place of a cap. So I know that EPA often encourages proposed prospective purchasers to come forward as soon as possible. And Paul, do you have any opinions on that?
Yeah, it's sort of like our whole job is spinning plates, right? And the first plate you have to spin is, okay, you know, can I get the property under contract? Okay. And then you got to see what the feedback is from the brokers on marketing the site. What could we build? And then put a plan together. While you're trying to do that, you're trying to understand the environmental. And that's usually the time, and to me it's very early in the process, where you say, okay, we need to sit down with, in our case here, EPA, PCA, and the Navy. Here's our initial plan. It changed 20 times, but here's our initial plan. It's industrial. There's no basements. There's no residential. Here's a draft schedule. What do you guys think? How can we work through this? And it took a year of those conversations and getting us into the VIC program. That it took a lot of work, and it was something that we did, okay, this seems to be working. Now we'll keep working and getting construction costs. We'll start working on our financing, getting the other plates spinning at the same time. So in our case, it really helped that we did that early. I couldn't have seen it working if we hadn't done it early.
Great, thank you. And so now I have a little treat for you. We actually have an additional two experts who are going to be joining our panel to answer your questions. We have the fabulous Sheila Desai, who is joining us. She knows the NIROP site inside and out because she's been the EPA Region 5 Remedial Project Manager on the site for the past 9 years. And Sheila is super creative, and like all great RPMs, she's willing to think outside the box. And she and Paul made a great innovative team on this site. So welcome, Sheila. And we also have the awesome Phil Page joining us. Phil is an attorney with the EPA's Office of Site Remediation Enforcement, and he is the liaison to the Superfund Redevelopment Initiative. He's also, like all of my favorite people, very creative and a great problem solver. So welcome, Phil. And that gets us into the next question. And this is a complicated question. So I'll be really interested to hear what our experts think, because all of the state programs are a little bit different. But here's the question. Can the Brownfields program be used to redevelop and clean up Superfund sites to state target levels? Who would like to take a shot at that?
Well, this is Tom Bloom, and I've been, you know, doing Superfund redevelopment for over 20 years, and I also have been stationed in the Brownfield section. Every year I read Brownfield's proposals and help the Brownfield's people out with their mission. And I know that we've been told that we can't combine Brownfields and Superfund in certain ways. And one of them is, for example, to do investigation type of stuff with our Superfund money, or to do it with Superfund money. Because, for example, in Brownfields, you're getting a grant to assess a property. And so when people come to me and they say, hey, can we use, you know, the redevelopment coordinator, and can we use redevelopment to help, you know, go with a cleanup, to get to a cleanup level and to do remedial stuff, I kind of say, no, you got to stay within the aspects of Superfund, not Brownfields. So I don't know if that answers the question or not, whether, you know, Brownfields can be used to determine a cleanup level or not, but I just know we've been told to try to not combine Superfund and Brownfields, because Superfund is already supposed to poke holes and do assessments. Why would we grant somebody money to poke holes and do assessments when a site's on the Superfund list and we're supposed to do that through Superfund?
Great. Thanks, Tom. Unless anyone else would like to answer that, I will go to another question, I think, is dovetails.
Kat, this is Phil. I agree with Tom, and in fact, the brownfields are defined within the Superfund law, but they specifically exclude Superfund sites for brownfields money. So Tom was saying you can't use Superfund monies to clean up brownfields, and more importantly, you can't use brownfield monies to clean up Superfund sites. And grant monies cannot be used for Superfund sites, as Tom pointed out, usually there's a potentially responsible party who has to clean up that site. They can't get those grant monies. So just the way the law is written, the two sites are really kind of completely different. That doesn't mean that you can't work with the Brownfields program if you have part of it. You can work with the Brownfields program, but you can't use Brownfields money for Superfund sites or vice versa. So,
great. Thank you, Phil. So this question, I think, dovetails very nicely, and here's the question. I would love to hear some details on how Paul Hyde convinced EPA to defer to the state voluntary cleanup program. In Massachusetts, we are redeveloping a Superfund site, and the EPA oversight slows everything down and requires review and approval at every step. This is in stark contrast to the majority of brownfield redevelopment in Massachusetts, which can occur on a development timeline under our state voluntary cleanup program. So, Paul, how did you convince EPA?
Yeah. I'd say that it perhaps is one of the most, maybe the most important decision in the whole project. And we did it by going out to sit down with the Region 5 folks early. We had a good idea of what we wanted to build. We had done 3 other Superfund sites, so we weren't some novice who was going to come in and like tear this thing apart and go bankrupt and leave a open hole. But I think perhaps most importantly, we had a great relationship with the state pollution control agency, and the state was comfortable moving jurisdiction over our redevelopment not over Navy or BAE or the Superfund stuff, but our redevelopment jurisdiction into the VIC unit. And the ultimate comment, I think, was made by the Region 5 lawyer. And I can't tell you what I did yesterday, but I remember that meeting. And he said, there is no reason that we should be monkeying around with trying to approve and manage a voluntary cleanup and redevelopment when we have a state that is a robust program and strong professionals that can do that for us. We'll retain our hooks into the Navy and BAE, but when it comes to your redevelopment, your communication and your approvals are through the state voluntary cleanup program. And that's how the thing went from, is this going to work, to go, to done.
Great. Thank you, Tom. And Sheila, you were the RPM on the site. What was your reaction when Paul sat down with the site team?
I believe that might have been right before I got the site that he sat down with the team. But just to answer the question a little bit from EPA side, this site, the NIRAP site, might be a little different than some of the other sites because all we had left for the soil was institutional controls and land use controls. So the majority of the cleanup from the Superfund perspective on the site for the soil was already conducted prior to the list pod. So there wasn't really anything to do except for delisting it. So that's what we went ahead. EPA met with Hyde and MPCA and the Navy. We discussed delisting the soil. And so that's when we went ahead and redefined the operable units to be able to do that, which helped with development. Since there wasn't, anything else really for EPA to do with the soil, as long as Hyde Development was doing it under the VIC program, and if they were going to move the soil, they were going to be addressing it through the cleanup program, it appeared okay by EPA.
Thank you. And here's a question actually on the operable units. And the question reads, can you share a bit more about the realignment of the operable unit at the site, specifically how it helped to expedite the cleanup and the redevelopment? And Sheila, do you want to expand upon your other answer?
Sure. So the operable units were defined. There was OU1 for groundwater, OU2 for, I believe it was soil outside the building that was not saturated. I'm not exactly, or under the building that was not saturated. And then OU3 was saturated soil. So it just seemed odd to have it defined that way. So we redefined it. We kept OU1 as groundwater, OU2 as soil except for the plating room because we knew the plating room still was probably the source of the material was, and the Navy needed that still as an operable unit to be able to get money. So OU3 became the soil under the plating room. And so we were able to delist OU2, which was all the rest of the soil not under the plating room. And make it available for grant money. And then OU3, we left that still listed on the MPL so the Navy could still address areas in that soil. And then eventually, that was after the buildings were taken down by Hyde Development, the Navy was able to go in and actually treat some of that soil and excavate it, and then we were able to delist OU3.
Very helpful. Thank you. So here's a question for Paul. Paul, what was the win percentage rate for the grant that you applied to?
I think it was probably 100%. We won 100%. Now, there's some subtlety to that. Sometimes it wasn't as much money as we asked for. The other piece of that is we work really hard at getting our costs ahead of time and sitting down with the grant funders ahead of time and saying, here's what we think we're coming in with. Here's where we think the different expenses are. And we'll get a lot of good feedback from the grant funders who will say, yeah, we're not going to pay for that, but we would pay for this, or, you know, you haven't demonstrated this clearly enough. You've got to build that case stronger. So we don't just, you know, crank the thing out in an hour and dump it in at the deadline. It's months of work go into this. And we're blessed to have a great staff in those chairs and a track record of spending the money wisely and delivering the jobs and tax-based results they need to go back to the legislature and get more money.
Great. Okay, so I think we have time for one more question. And Paul, I am going to refer this to you as well. And the question is, can you comment on how you select your environmental consultant and contractors on a job as complicated and big as this one?
Great question. We are super focused. So the biggest risk for us is there's a bust on the environmental side or there's a bust on the grading side. We did the cleanup, but we put the dirty stuff in a green space, or we're short on where we need to be for the grades, or it didn't compact right. There's all sorts of concerns about utilities. So we're really focused on engineers that are pragmatic and that have a strong civil engineering background and have done a lot of work with construction and development. And folks have to be able to take risk with when we have a hard time with consultants saying, I don't know. It's like, well, we bought a Superfund site without being able to do all of the investigation we would normally do. So we need someone that can take a risk, and then we need someone that's good with civil engineering construction. And then finally, we spend a lot of money and time on sort of recreating the history of the site, looking at all the old plans, talking to people that operated there, understanding how things ran in the building, so to figure out where those hot spots might be. And we spend a lot of money on testing and try and get as macro a view as we can as possible. We hate soil borings. I'd rather use a backhoe. You just see so much more when you start tearing a site apart with a backhoe than you do with a soil boring. So those are some comments on that.
Thanks, Tom.
Yes.
I'm sorry. Thank you, yes. Paul.
Yeah.
So we have just a few more minutes, so let's go ahead and wrap this up. I want to thank everyone for participating today. I want to thank you for your feedback and for your questions. A big thank you to EPA Superfund Redevelopment and Frank Avasado for hosting this valuable series of webinars. And, of course, a ginormous thank you to Paul Hyde, to Tom Bloom, to Sheila and Phil for making this such a wonderful event. And if you did not get your question answered, EPA will email you and provide you with an answer, and you can have a discussion there. So with that, I'm going to turn it back over to Jean.
All right. Thank you so much. I'm going to go ahead and just walk through a few quick reminders before we close things out today. So the first thing I want to do is echo Kat's thanks. We did have over 170 individuals join us for today's live broadcast. So I want to thank those of you who took time out of your day to join us, as well as our presenters and organizers who were able to share their expertise and help put together today's session. We will continue to offer sessions like this on the Cleanup Information Network at cluin.org, so I encourage you to sign up for our free monthly newsletter, Tech Direct, which goes out on the first of each month. If you're looking for copies of the presentation materials, we already have those posted. You'll find it on the seminar homepage. So as we discussed at the beginning, I reference you back to the page that you used when you checked in. There's a tab for slides and resources. If you look on the middle right under related URLs, you can scroll through there. There's a wide collection of websites and other documents. You'll see a link to the seminar resources page as well. So you can click that and press the Browse To button to open it up. Those links are still active, so if you're watching the recorded version, you can also click through those links and open up those pages on your end. I'll ask each of you to fill out our brief online feedback form to let us know what you thought of today's delivery, both in how we delivered as well as the content that was covered. If you're looking for CEUs or PDHs, we don't offer those credit hours. However, we can give you a participation certificate, and many individuals are able to get credit with their own institutions by keeping the certificate, copies of the materials, and their registration form or registration confirmation email to document their attendance. Please be sure when filling that certificate or form out, in order to get the certificate, make sure your email address is entered correctly and check the box at the bottom of the form certifying you were there for the entire session. This also goes for those of you replaying the recorded version. Once you submit that form, you should then immediately have access to a certificate that you can download or print out for your own record. And as noted at the start of today's session, it was recorded, and you'll automatically receive an email when this archive is available for on-demand playback. It usually takes us about 1 to 2 weeks, so we appreciate your patience as we continue to move forward. And again, keep your eyes out for that email in the near future. So with that, I'll go ahead and formally conclude today's live broadcast. Thank you so very much for joining us.